You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.
Escribo sobre un destino que apenas puedo tocar. En tanto un niño se inventa con pegamento un hogar, mientras busco las palabras hacer esta canción. Un niño esquiva las balas que buscan su corazón. Acurrucado en mi calle duerme un niño y la piedad arma lejos un pesebre y juega la Navidad. Arma lejos un pesebre y juega la Navidad. Y juega la Navidad. Y juega, y juega, y juega. De nuestro olvido pide limosna en un bar y lava tu parabrisas por un peso, por un pan. Si las flores del futuro crecen con tanto dolor, seguramente mañana será un mañana sin sol. Acurrucado en mi calle duerme un niño y la piedad arma lejos un pesebre y juega la Navidad. Arma lejos un pesebre y juega la Navidad. Y juega la Navidad. Y juega, y juega, y juega.
That was the incredible Mercedes Sosa. She says, as I search for the words to write this song, I look at a child outside whose body's trying to skip the bullets, you know, coming at them. And she's talking about the incredible inequity and the incredible suffering of millions of children worldwide. She's talking about this idea, this of reality that we construct justifies inequality. Just a beautiful melody. Someone who has written extensively about inequality is Dr. Darren Lahn. He's my guest this morning. Dr. Darren Lahn is associate professor in the Faculty of Education at the University of Calgary, where he examines social justice activism in schools and communities. He's also an award-winning recipient for his research on social justice. He's published more than 175 articles, and his latest book, The Northern White, is a book that is bound to not only raise awareness of the issues of inequality and how white privilege is connected to social justice. We're very privileged to have you on our show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, in your book, you talk particularly about the historical privilege entrenched within white. I was reading an article, and in the journalist asked a black person, a poor rural Mississippi person, says, you know, what is white? And this man said, well, certainly not black. So what is white?
That is a really good question, because my co-editor and I, Paul Carr, he's another white fellow from Canada, and we met at a conference in the U.S. We were at the National Association for Multicultural Ed, which is predominantly black educators from the United States. And we were kind of like the only two white guys in the room, and also just both happened to be Canadian. And so we, of course, sat together and ended up sharing lunch and some thoughts about doing anti-racism work in Canada, both of us in different parts of Canada and different backgrounds. But that was kind of one of our questions. It's kind of interesting that two white guys are doing this work, and yet most white people don't even think of themselves as white people. In fact, we don't use that word typically to describe ourselves. And in fact, it almost seems like it's such a norm in Canada. And that, I think, is part of the issue here, is that we're just people, you know. So that's one of our privileges, is that we there's such a normative stance around whiteness that we can just say, I don't have a race, I'm just a person. The rest of the world is raced. The rest of the world has races and cultures, and those we need to dissect, take apart, question, criticize, and look for deficits, because we're just the model of normal human beingness, you might say. And that mentality, that we're just nice people and the rest of the world is sort of up for study, is I think part of that whole colonial mindset that really elevates whiteness, even though it's not spoken and even though it's denied, elevates whiteness to this sort of supreme state of being without saying so.
When I was reading your book, The Great White North, Exploring Whiteness, Privilege, Identity, and Education, I'm wondering, how do you see the connection between this stratification of society on racial terms and the inequality that we see, you know, the abject poverty of some and the incredible wealth of a very few?
We live, I think, in a world that believes, like a particularly North American society, Canadian and U.S., that we're almost pure meritocracies, right? So we get places in life because we work hard. And so we're kind of trained to think that way, in that the people who do really, really well must have worked the hardest, and those who are struggling, the people in the margins of society, those who find doors closing for them, it must be through their own faults. They either aren't working hard enough, or they're imagining something that's not theirs, that these barriers aren't real. And I think we tell ourselves that, and that we, being white people, tell ourselves that to make ourselves feel a bit better, convincing ourselves that we're living in a completely egalitarian world that's fair to everyone. But, you know, it doesn't take too much analysis to look through that and to help fracture that a little bit. And particularly Paul and I do it with our own students in faculties of education, where these young adults are going to go out and be teachers. And they've always just thought of themselves as good people, and they probably are, and that our society is a good place to live. You know, everybody believes Canada's the best country in the world for so many good reasons. But we're kind of invisible, most of us, to a lot of the inequalities that you're talking about. So I think opening people's eyes to that, and then helping them see how it isn't a level playing field, how some people do face more barriers, and other people and face privileges. And I mean, it isn't just as simple as black and white. Obviously, it's a very complex and nuanced situation, but there are many, many privileges accrued to people based on the fact that they have white skin. There are so many privileges that we don't even see ourselves receiving. And opening opening up people's eyes to that is it's a challenge, but it's also very rewarding. Once you kind of see inequality and see how we as white people are implicated in it, that's the most difficult thing to discover, but also the most painful, I think, for white people, because you can get kind of paralyzed with this feeling of, oh my God, I've never thought of myself as being part of racism.
I was reading Bell Hooks, and she talks about how being black is an exhausting state of mind. You're constantly aware and thinking of everything that signifies being in this skin, in this body. Sometimes I think the part of the problem is this barrier that is raised. As you point out, for some people, their skin color protects them from that necessity to look at the world and to be mindful and present in every second, right? So the option to not look, as John Berger says, you know, to look is also a choice. So what does it mean when white people, if we were to say that, refuse to look and say, you know, well, it's too big a problem, you know, we can't solve it. How did we get here, and what can we do to move forward?
That's a really big question, and I think a really good one. And I mean, there are different parts of it that maybe I can try and address. And one is this: how did we get here? The historical piece, and that's implicated as well, I think, with the idea that I can't even look at this. I mean, my grandparents never owned slaves. I'm not a racist. I didn't create the colonial model. You know, I wasn't one of the explorers. So, I mean, you can rationalize in so many different ways how historically you're not part of it, but we're all currently living here in it and enjoying the privileges that come as a result of it. So I think it does behoove each one of us to study that. But as you say, it's very challenging to have people choose to see this. Dr. Carl James at York University uses this analogy that it's like moving into a home that has a faulty furnace and living in the home and saying, we need to do something about this furnace, versus saying, oh, no, it happened before I got here. It's not my responsibility. It's long before I came. We wouldn't say that. We would actually say, no, it's, even though we're living here now, it wasn't our fault, but it is something that needs fixing. And I think that is the way with racial inequality, that even though it may have come out of a historical period or a set of historical circumstances, to me seems like a good way to implicate everybody and say, no, we each do have to look at this now. But getting people to that place where they can see how the privileges they enjoy, even the privilege, as you say, of turning away from it, the privilege of saying, I don't think about race, you know, that kind of thing. And yet, it's on everyone's mind, it's in the back of our minds all the time. But we've now been trained in this current society, I think, to be so overly polite. Yeah, polite, but not respectful necessarily. So almost ultra-sensitive to racialized issues, and yet unable to address them in any meaningful way. So the alternative has been to create this belief that colorblindness is the goal. So we hear a lot of our student teachers say, oh, I don't see color in my classroom because I'm not racist, so I just look out and see a bunch of smiling kids, and I never, ever, ever notice what color they are. Seems to me inadequate and actually not the goal. That's not the way to treat people respectfully, is to ignore their identities.
In your book, you talk about this onion, right? Peeling the onions of society. And I think about all the social institutions that we participate that reinforce that message that there is a privileged class. How this legacy of injustice not only continues to be maintained by the education system, but it's also perpetuated and reacted in the classroom.
Right. And I mean, I think you can notice just visually, if you go and look at any new incoming class of teacher candidates, just like any incoming class of firefighters or police officers or bankers, there's a predominant whiteness about that group that's even whiter than Canadian society, right? So in Canada, about 1 in 5 people is a visible minority, as the census calls them, or a non-white person. But in our teacher programs and other, you know, institutions, some of them seem quite white. You think, well, you know, that's not our fault. They're just people who who did really well in school like school, so they come back to work in them, right? So people who felt marginalized, people who felt like they weren't part of the system, whose identities weren't recognized in the curriculum, in the textbooks, in any of their principals or teachers, why would they be attracted to work in a field like that? It's interesting to see how that's one way that inequality can be perpetuated. If you think about sexism and how the word fireman or policeman, I mean, why are mainly males attracted to those lines of work? It's just become our way of thinking about them, right? And so I am a bit defensive when people say, oh, now white people are the new minority, and my cousin's white, and he couldn't get a job on the police force because he's white. And I tell them that that's not true, and that their cousin is probably a bit of a loser, because many, many white people still do very, very well getting onto police forces and other lines of work. It probably was something wrong with their cousin, but...
That's a very good point, though. What would you say to someone who says, you know, I've been poor all my life, I've struggled and faced so many barriers, you know, I mean, how can you tell me I'm privileged?
Exactly, and I mean, I think that's part of my own personal narrative, in that I grew up in a sort of a tough part of town, or working class, or lower part of town, and my white parents didn't have a lot of economic privilege, so... You know, it seemed, you know, I've been trained to think that any successes I've had academically and otherwise have been because I've worked really hard. But I've also had to kind of relook at that narrative, and that I've never had any doors closed to me because of my identity. I've never come late to a meeting and had people ascribe that to my group, my people, you know, my race. So I've enjoyed a lot of privileges even along the way. So I can say that obviously economics is another intersecting factor, you know, or maybe ability and disability as well. You could say, you know, there are just so many complex parts of our identity that can work in different ways, sometimes in contradictory ways, right? That you can find white people that are highly economically disadvantaged, and then some, you know, First Nations people who are affluent. So you could say, well, see, it's all random, but in fact, the predominance situation kind of shows us that it's not just chance, that there are many, many circumstantial things that that work to privilege certain groups of people. How it plays out in the classroom, I think, is I think it requires a really complex look at diversity beyond just the superficial kind of, you know, we're all different, so we're all really unique and good. There's sort of a way to do it that's quite superficial, and that keeps hierarchies entrenched, and then there are ways of doing it that I think are much more sort of systemic, and that get at the underlying attitudes that are actually about white supremacy, and trying to work our ways around that. But it is an ongoing and very complex work, I think.
So how does the media promote a racist society or racialization in society?
Well, sometimes, like if you watch right-wing media, it's just so obvious. It's almost cartoon-like how they do it. In fact, when all of their on-air personalities are white, and when everything they ever say about the other, with a capital O and in quotation marks, about the other, so the dangerous other, whether it's immigrants or First Nations people or any people of color or particular groups, maybe it's militant Sikhs or maybe it's Asian youth gangs or, you know, something that invokes fear in the white majority, we can see how, you know, they perpetuate fear when the statistics don't actually back it up. When, yes, there are these extreme cases of violence, but we never think of Hell's Angels and biker gangs as white gangs, right? So those criminal groups are highly racialized. They're very white, and yet they are never talked about in racial terms. So that's one way. And if a young group of delinquents does something, they're never considered a terrorizing white gang, even though all of the perpetrators may be white. There's also the fact that crime statistics show that crime is down in Canada, and crime stats are dropping year after year after year. We're actually living in one of the least violent times in the last decade. And youth crime is down, and youth violent crime is down. So it just, the media does not let us know about that. The media, you know, fuels something else. It fuels, you know, this culture of fear and easy targets and really false notions of who we should fear. But it also promotes who we should admire and emulate. And if you just look at the promotions page in the Globe and Mail, you know, who did really well this week in corporate Canada, it's unbelievably white. I mean, it just reminds us of who's doing really, really well. And so I've done this, what would be considered by most healthy Canadians, a racist activity. It's just go through the paper and circle all the faces in the section of any newspaper, whether it's your daily in your community, like the Calgary Herald for me, and just circle all the faces in one section of the paper and see how are my people being represented. So if you're a person of color or a First Nations person, how are my people being represented? You know, does the number of faces in the newspaper reflect the population in Canada? And it almost never does. And also, in what ways are different racialized identities being portrayed? So who's shown in a more complex array of occupations, and who is just shown as either criminals or entertainers? And so those kinds of activities can be really eye-opening, that you can't look at the paper the same way. You can't watch the news the same way without seeing. And I think Paul and I have both shared these stories that we just love when our students come back and say, "You've wrecked the news. I can't watch the news anymore. I can't watch." You know, when you watch television, it's so shocking. It's almost like just getting a new filter to see the world, and then you can't go back.
So what can we do? How do we create awareness? How do we create a society that's not divided into racialized identities and us and them?
It doesn't require us saying, let's not look at difference anymore, because I think those, you know, the histories and just the cultural differences are so fascinating and part of what makes life on Earth interesting, and that is our differences are richly rewarding. And but I think seeing those differences through a lens or through a conceptual framework or a way of thinking about the world that doesn't privilege whiteness over others is a very challenging thing to do. To think that every human life has the exact same value is a way more difficult challenge than you might imagine. And so, but how do we get there? I mean, in such incremental ways, it seems like an almost impossible task. But I think for us in the luxury of, you know, our relatively peaceful society in North America with, you know, really safe classrooms and all of that, we have this real luxurious situation that we're in where, as educators, we can feel free to really deconstruct and critique this society we're living in a way that we hope will move it forward and not just leave people paralyzed by white guilt or paralyzed by believing that you're either a perpetrator or a victim. There are just ways in which we can all find ourselves implicated that by leveling the playing field, I'm not harming myself. But as a white person, I'm not actually you know, eliminating racism or eliminating barriers around race, around race privileges or around gender and all of that. It doesn't diminish my life, but in fact it enhances it, because we will benefit from the greatest number of people being fully involved in the society and enjoying a more, I think, a richer life. And so it isn't about us losing something, but really about all of us gaining, I would say. You know, if that's the core of the message, then any of the messy ways that we get there, I think, are sort of justified. And, I mean, there are, you know, activities we can do in class to talk about privilege. A difficult one is having, I find this one a real challenge, but having students line up at the end of one wall in a room and then having them step forward, let's say, if they have a parent who has a university education, or take two steps forward if they had a lot of books in their house, take a step forward if their parents both speak English or if their parents have a university degree, and you can keep doing this, or if they've ever been followed around a store because of their identity, take two steps back. And we can just look at, you know, you who ends up at the end of the room, and it's typically middle-class white people who are highly privileged even before they start their university education. So we all have to work together on this, and I'm still trying to better understand it as a person who's trying to unlearn racism.
In terms of the institutions that we continuously uphold, we look at things like immigration, right? We have Jason Kenney stating openly, I plead guilty, I'm a racist. And, you know, and what does that signal to our society? Can this transformation that you speak of be possible without acknowledging what role power and influence play in this transformation?
No, it can't, and I think power is the key to all of this, and I think it's what differentiates our approach from just a sort of a colorblind, we're all beautiful parts of a rainbow and hold hands kind of a mentality, which feels good, but doesn't get us anywhere. So I think acknowledging who holds the power and how those systems of power are maintained through government, through institutions. Our whole world is politicized, and our whole world is based on power and economics, and of course the money is part of the power structure. And so I think having leadership from above is such a key, and with our current government, in fact, we've seen a stepping back from and the dismantling of many of the structural ways that we've developed to sort of address inequality. And so I think there's going to have to be the reestablishment of institutional and sort of systemic ways of supporting the efforts to challenge inequality in Canada. But raising people's awareness of how power is implicated in all of it is really key.
Thank you so much for joining us. My guest is Darren Lunn. He is a professor at the Faculty of the University of Calgary, Faculty of Education. He's also the president of the Alberta Association for Multicultural Education. He serves on Diversity, Equity, and Human Rights Committees of the Alberta Teachers Association. And his latest book is The Great White North, Exploring Whiteness, Privilege, and Identity. How can people access your book?
Amazon.ca is probably good, and just search Great White North and should find us alongside Bob and Doug McKenzie with their a little more lighthearted version.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye now.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.